Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Mental Illness Matters. My name is Chrissy Hodges, and I'm your host. You are listening to a show that is designed to dismantle the stigma that surrounds mental illness. In that way, we bring guests on who live successfully with mental illness to talk about that, what they've been through and how their story has turned out to be positive recovery. I'll also bring on organizations that talk about what they do to help individuals and families as a support system that deal with mental illness, but also who have devoted their time and effort to eliminating stigma. There's so many things that happen in the media that are contributing to the stigma that keep people silent and also keep people from getting help for mental illness. And in this show, my hope is that we can definitely put a face and a voice to what mental illness is and how many thousands of people all around you are living with a mental illness, and they live normal, functional lives and live happy lives. So that's what the show is about. So thank you for tuning in. Today we are going to have an interview, a one-on-one interview with myself, and then I will have a couple co-hosts come on. And we're going to talk about mental illness and violence with them, and it's going to be about a 45-minute to an hour discussion on some of the events that have happened in the media recently. But first, and most importantly, just wanted to talk one-on-one with a good friend of mine and a fellow advocate. His name is David Kramer. He sold his second successful custom software business in 2000 at age 51 and began a teaching career. His goal is to help the next generation take its place in the world. A university teacher, he also has a BS in mathematics, Phi Beta Kappa, an MS in computer science with 3 excellent awards. David has climbed all 54 of Colorado's 14ers, mountains over 14,000 feet, and lives in Denver, Colorado. I had the pleasure of meeting David when we were both in the Toastmasters chapter here in Denver in Cherry Creek. Both learning how to speak in public. And so it's very fitting that here we are on the podcast. Welcome to the show, David. Hello? Are you there, David? On just yet. Can you hear me, David?
Hello?
Okay, well, maybe he is not called in just yet. Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Oh, now I can hear you. Yay!
Yes, I hear you. I heard the whole thing. I heard you fine.
Were you going, "I'm here, Chrissy, I'm here, Chrissy"?
I was waving, but you didn't see it.
Well, just David, so you know, and just for my listeners, I'm still getting used to all the gadgets here at Blog Talk Radio. So one of these days, I will not have a massive mistake. But luckily, that didn't last. Welcome to the show, David. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me, Chrissy.
Well, David has been on with me before when I was at Cosmic Broadcasting a long time ago. And just if I could quickly share, David, when I first brought David on, he was not very open and or was a little reluctant about talking about what you have been through and mental health. And after being on the show, I mean, things just seriously blew up for you in a good way. Talking about the illness, and you've just reached so many milestones, I think. So I'm so excited that we kind of shared that journey together, for sure.
Thank you. I have to thank you for it, too, for what you do and for helping me come out of my shell. It's made a big difference for me and for others around me.
So let's get right into it. We have about a half hour to talk. So let's talk a little bit, David, about tell me and the listeners, tell us a little bit about what your life has been like, some of the background on your mental illness.
Well, it first broke out, I have bipolar disorder. I like to call it manic depression because it describes miraculously what the illness is. When I was 18, it first emerged, and that was in 1967. I'm 65 years old now. And at the time, mental illness was really, 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 really not talked about. And it never occurred to me I had one. I thought everybody lived the way I lived. And we went undiagnosed for 24 years. I went through several manic and depressive episodes, sometimes mostly long manic episodes followed by long depressive episodes. And finally, in 1991, when I was 42, someone suggested to me that maybe you should look into maybe have manic depression. It was called manic depression then. And I did, and I have a cousin who works in the who's a psychiatrist, called him, spent 2 hours on the phone, and referred me to somebody in Denver, and sure enough, I was diagnosed with the illness. So it was both a tremendous blow, but a tremendous relief, because I remember saying to myself, at least that explains a lot of behavior. And that was something that I couldn't understand, why I was behaving in certain ways, which were not sensible, not rational, but I was doing them. And then it took me several years to kind of find my bearings on taking my medication regularly, and I thought I was very religious about taking my medication. And it took me 3 or 4 years until I was able to ask the question, well, where do I end and the illness begin? And then it took me a long time to answer that question. My answer was, I don't end and the illness begins. The illness is part of me. And that was when I was a defining moment, when I recognized that the illness is a part of me, just like my personality and my humor, whatever I have, and any other aspect of me is there. So is my illness. So when I recognized it was a part of me, it was a major breakthrough. It took many years to get to that point. So my hope in talking with you and in reaching the people that I've reached since I've talked with you is that I can spare them some of the disruption in life that my illness caused.
I'm going to tell you, I love that what you discovered, and I love that saying about where do you end and the mental illness begins, or vice versa, where does the mental illness end and you begin? I love that quote, and I just want you to know that I have used that several times when I'm speaking, and I do give you kudos.
Well, thank you. I appreciate using it. I hope it helps. My goal is to help people who have, so they don't have to go through what I went through.
Well, here's a question for you. When you said, I think it's really common for people when they are diagnosed to have that initial feeling of relief, the oh my goodness, thank goodness there's an explanation for all this, the craziness that's been going on in my mind. But you also said it was kind of a blow. Now, and it took you a few years to get your bearings. What was it that was the most, what was the biggest about that blow? I mean, was it the stigma surrounding it? Was it, just the fact that you couldn't accept that you actually had a mental illness? Tell me a little bit about that.
It was the stigma. I accepted right away that I had it, because I was, on the one hand, I was relieved that that was the source of my irrational behavior for many years. But yes, the stigma, I can't tell anybody about this. They'll think I'm crazy, literally and figuratively. Or, it's a big blot on your persona to have a mental illness. And so that was the main negative part for me, and accepting that I have something that is so negatively looked upon by so many people. So that was the main reason behind that.
And David, you went a long time without telling people, correct?
Yes. With a long time. Mm-hmm. It took me 6 months to tell my family. Excuse me, 3 months. It took me 3 months to tell my family, because I wanted to see if the medication was going to help at all. And when I first informed my family, I wrote them a long letter. My parents, my mother, my siblings, my daughters, wrote them a long letter about it. And the reaction was, well, he's just off on one of his things again. This is 1991, 1992. So it wasn't even accepted then that it was possible I had such an illness. It was like I was using this to excuse my behavior. So even that was difficult with my own family to get used to. Even though there was a history of mental illness in the family, there's a history on my father's side, there's a history of mental illness. And by 1991, it was known that it does run in families. So even with that, it was like I was just trying to pull another trick here with my irrational behavior. So that part was hard.
Now, with your other family members that had mental illness issues, did they believe that those were real?
Well, I'm the only one in my generation who has it, who has a mental illness. There were my father's sisters had, there were a few who had some mental illnesses, and there are others in the family I don't want to go into. But I was, since I'm the only one in my generation, there was really no one else in my generation to talk to about it. So it was a difficult thing to try to get used to, that it was being denied. And that was one of the reasons that's one of the elements of stigma behind it, is denial. You know, you don't have a mental illness, you can possibly be crazy.
Mm-hmm. The excuse piece is pretty interesting. You're just using that as an excuse for your irrational behaviors.
Yeah, well, at the time, mental illness wasn't talked about that much. It was still not, quote, out of the closet, unquote, the way it is today, or it's getting there. It's not really quite out of the closet yet. There's still a lot of stigmas associated with it, as you well know, which is why you're doing what you're doing. But fortunately, after a few years, I got a phone call from my sister about 5-6 years after I was diagnosed, and she said she had just read the book An Unquiet Mind, which is the best book I've ever seen about bipolar disorder. And she said she never really understood what I went through, and she, could we start again? And that was a really turning point in my family to accept the fact that I had a mental illness, and that I was dealing with it, and that it was at times easy to deal with, at times tough to deal with. And I started getting a lot of support from the family, and now it's a very loving, warm relationship I have with my family.
So has it gotten easier for you? Before we get into the things that you do on a daily basis or over the throughout the years to get to where you are now living with bipolar, I just wanted to ask, is it easier for you now to tell people and to be more open? And what was the catalyst for that changing, if so?
Well, I'm talking to the catalyst right now, Chrissy. Don't you know that? Yes, you were the catalyst. You were the catalyst. I was, in recent years, until I met you and went on your show, if I was close enough to somebody, then I would start talking about it. But I didn't really start talking about it and kind of openly. But since I was on your show and since you helped me with coming out of my shell, it's been very easy for me to talk about it. I teach in here in Denver. I teach at a university in Denver. And I inject into my classes a 1 or 2 minute entering the real world kind of conversation, because I realize that schools still aren't teaching real world skills. You know, I teach computer science, and yes, you're supposed to teach computer science, but not many computer science teachers talk about things like how to get great reference letters, or how do you start saving money, or how do you resolve conflicts, or things like that. So I started talking about that, and then at some point, once they've gotten used to me talking about real-world things, I tell them, by the way, I have bipolar disorder, and if you think you have something like that, or you know somebody like that, take care of it now so you don't have to waste 24 years of your life going through it. So it's very easy for me to say that right now. And I know for a fact that it's helped, because several students have come to me and said because of what I disclosed, they sought help, and that's been very gratifying. So. So you're the catalyst, Chrissy.
Thank you so much. I mean, I knew that first of all, I was always hoping that I wasn't like enthusiastically forcing you to talk about it.
I'm a big boy. I can make up my own mind.
But I really appreciate that. And I do want to say that I was able and fortunate to be able to go to one of David's classes when he disclosed that information about bipolar. And now, David, remind me, was that the first time that you did? Or did I attend the first time?
Yes, that was the first time. I had been giving talks to my students in class, and then I organized a talk that I opened up to the department, to students in the department. And at the end of the talk, I disclosed the whole concept of the whole issue of mental illness, that I had one, that, you know, if you think you have something, if you think something's not quite right, take care of it now. And at that talk, when you were there, you were standing in the back, after the talk, one student came up to me and said, I think I have what you're talking about. And he's one of the ones who told me subsequently that because of me, he went to get help. So that was very gratifying that it happened right away. And since then, other students have come to me with that. So I hope I've saved some. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think that that's exactly what, you know, David, I always say when I'm giving a speech, if it can just change one person's mind or if it can help one single person, then it's all worth it. And you're living that right now.
Well, I'm trying to be helpful. I know what I went through. I know what 24 years cost me not being diagnosed. I mean, there was positive aspects of it, there were negative aspects of it, but the overall balance was it was really took a lot out of me for those 24 years. So if I can save somebody from experiencing that, I'll be very happy about that.
Well, so during that time, from when you were diagnosed until where you are now, tell us a little bit about what it was like developing coping skills and developing a lifestyle where you could manage the disorder, and was that tumultuous? And then what do you do now to maintain kind of a stable mind, I guess, for lack of a better terminology?
Well, the first tool I used to help stabilize was something that my doctor recommended, my psychiatrist recommended, which was to keep track of my moods. And this may sound very funny, but at the age 42, I first learned the fact that I had moods, that the tumult that was going on in my mind, the mood swings, which is another nickname for bipolar disorder, the mood swings made it very difficult for me to figure out what was, quote, normal, unquote. So tracking my moods first enabled me to start tapping into my mind and saying, what am I feeling now? What does this feel like? Does it feel manic? Does it feel depressive? Does it feel angry? Do I feel happy? Do I feel sad? Do I feel crazy? And starting to track that was a real, very powerful tool to enable me to get a grip on my moods so I can detect when something was coming on that didn't sound quite right. Because up until then, I had no yardstick to measure what was normal, what was not normal. So for several years, I kept track on a daily basis, four, five, six times a day, recording my moods and assigning a number to them, and so I could relate, you know, from 0 to 10, I can relate, well, this feels like a 7, this feels like a 5, this feels like a 1, and then I can start getting a handle. And I noticed the stabilization over time as I started getting a better handle on recognizing my moods and then working to be aware of them and then being able to respond to them and not let them take over me. And you know, there were times when it did take over me. Even under medication, I still had manic and depressive episodes, but they were nowhere near as long and as extensive and strong as they were before medication. Mm-hmm. What I do now is I've been very fortunate. The last really 5 or 6 years have been very calm, relatively calm. I still experience depression. There are days when I wish I didn't have to go to school or wish I didn't have to get up and get out of bed, but I kind of force myself because I have a contract to fulfill, and that helps me get out of bed. It helps me when I realize I'm responsible to other people. That helps me get out of bed. But for the most part, I've been very fortunate the last 5 or 6 years that it's been very quiet. So I can't say that I do proactively a lot of conscious coping skills now, although I'm always aware of what my moods are. And when I see something coming on that doesn't feel right, I've learned enough most of the time to say, something's not right here. I need to look at that and stop what I'm doing and maybe just my medication or maybe just write it out. And being aware that I'm in a different kind of mood right now. So I'd say in the last 5 or 6 years, I've been very fortunate about it.
That has to be some incredible self-awareness.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I mean, that has to be some incredible self-awareness.
Well, that's what the illness has done for me. And that's been a positive outcome from all this, is self-awareness, is being aware of how I feel, when I feel, what I feel, why I feel that way. And that's been a very powerful stabilizer for me.
So I have a question for you just based on what you were just describing. So, I mean, I think that many of us, it takes a long time to recognize any sort of mood or a shift in mood. But and for those of us that do not experience bipolar disorder, it's, oh, okay, here's this mood. This is what I feel right now. Hopefully it'll pass, or I do what I need to do to deal with this mood. Now, I realize that you definitely have mood shifts and a differing mood just normally outside of bipolar. So
right.
Do you have any indication or is, you know, any kind of alarm bells for those of us that don't have bipolar, don't understand it?
You know, my alarm bell is absurdity. If a thought is absurd, or if a feeling is absurd, I say to myself, that's coming from somewhere that's not happening in my normal day here today. So if it's irrational, it makes no sense, if it's something that I see will have a negative consequence if I follow through with that thought or feeling, then that's my signal. That's my catch-all for, hey, is this a normal feeling or is this a beginning of a mood swing for me that I have to deal with differently from the normal ups and downs of every day?
Mm-hmm.
So I stop and look and see, is this a normal thing that I'm thinking right now or feeling right now? Is it appropriate to the situation? I guess that's a better way of putting it. Is my feeling or thought appropriate to what's going on right now in my surroundings? And that's been very helpful.
So I do want to move on. Now, you mentioned earlier that you do this class about entering the real world, which I think is so cool, and that would have been really helpful for me when I was in college. All the obstacles that you face, you have no clue what's going on. And so you also have written a book about this very topic. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and tell us where the inspiration or the reasoning behind the book came from, and definitely let us know where we can purchase the book.
Okay, thank you. Well, the inspiration came from the positive results I was getting, the positive responses and reactions I was getting from my students when I talked about the real world situation, the real world situations. And this was in the fall of 2013 when I first started injecting this into my classes. And then I gave this talk that you were there to the entire math department, and it was very well received. And then the semester ended, and I thought, you know, maybe there's a market for something like this. I can see that these kind of basic tools that I provide are very powerful. And the key thing that I put in the book are ideas that can be applied right away. A lot of self-help books require, like, you change your perspective on life, or you say these things to yourself 100 times a day, or things like that, you know, self-talk and all that. But these were the ideas that I was conveying in class were ones that you don't need any special talent or time to start to apply them. And that was the motivation behind writing a book. I thought this would be useful to people that age, in, you know, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, first starting their life outside of school. And that was the motivation to writing the book. And I also wanted to show that when I wrote the book, I was thinking about how much of myself should I put into it, how much of my mental illness and background should I put into it. And then I didn't make that a big part of the book. A lot of people who are caught coming out of the shell with mental illnesses write memoirs. And I wanted to show that you can write a book with, quote, normal topics, unquote, whatever the word normal means, by the way, that you can write a book with normal topics and still, even though, quote, I have a mental illness. And that was one of my goals in writing the book, that the book is very sane. You know, it's got a lot of powerful, positive, useful ideas. I've gotten very positive feedback from it, from people who have read it, people in my target market, meaning, you know, the late teens, early 20s. I've got very positive feedback, like, this is wonderful stuff, thank you, you saved me a lot of time, and things like that. And so that was the main reason behind it. And I was very fortunate. The first publisher I went to said they want to publish it. And that was a very, very fortunate thing, because most people, when they first write a book, they have to go through dozens of people, dozens of publishers, to find a book. And it was, in fact, my publisher who suggested the title, Entering the Real World. It was much better childhood than I had. I had learning after college, but entering the real world is also good for people who don't go to college. So I thought it was a much better title that could reach a much better audience. And the book's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available from the publisher, Roman, www.roman.com. And it's there for the taking. Well, there for the buying, excuse me, not for the taking.
Entering the Real World?
Entering the Real World, and my name is David Kramer. It's with a K. Mm-hmm. And you can just search for it on any of the common books. Tattered Cover covers it. You can get it through Tattered Cover in Denver. In fact, I have a book signing there on April 20th.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We'll do our best to advertise that leading up to it.
Thank you.
To come.
Thank you.
I know a lot of people a lot older than your target demographic that could use your book.
Am I talking to one?
Yeah, I know, right?
Just kidding.
To learn for sure. I remember when I graduated from college and had no clue what I was doing or no clue what I wanted to do. I always thought I wanted to write a book called The Terrible 20s because I just thought the 20s is the most horrible time of your life because you're trying to disconnect from everything that you've ever known to try to find who you are, and it is just a miserable mess. Would have been really helpful for me.
Well, thank you. And I talk about that in the book quite a bit also, about defining your goals and defining success for yourself, for example. The word success is thrown around a lot. And, just what is success? What does success mean to an individual? And many times people live somebody else's idea of success. And it took me a long time to realize that I have to define it for myself. What is important to me? What does success mean to me? And then go after that rather than, a family's dream or a friend's dream or Madison Avenue's dream of success, things like that. So I talk about that quite a bit in the book also.
And
that's normal stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. However, I do have a question. Tell me a little bit about... Tell me how the idea of success could possibly change for someone who is diagnosed with a mental illness. Could that be a harder term or a harder way to live? Or how could the idea of success change as someone who lives with a mental illness?
That's a great question. It's a very individualized answer also for each person. So I really can't presume to talk for anybody else, but I can picture in my own experience. There was the pre-realization that the mental illness is a part of me that I accept, just like if I were to have diabetes or if I were to have some other illness, that's a part of me. And once I got to that point, then it was easier for me to throw off others' ideas of success. And once I acknowledged that, yes, I have mental illness, but it doesn't define me. It doesn't determine who I am as a human being. What I do and what I do with and for other people defines me as a human being, defines me what I am as a human being. And that's when I was able to start formulating a better idea of success. I stopped chasing money as one of the success factors. I started chasing how can I help people. And that's one of the reasons that I sold my business to go into teaching, because I want to be able to help the next generation take its place in the world. So I don't think I'm answering your question directly, but I'm trying to say that it's really an individual thing, and you have to pass through. If you do have a mental illness, I think you have to get to that point of self-acceptance. Then you can start defining a whole lot of things for yourself a whole lot better than if you're struggling with dealing with a stigma or thinking less of yourself because you have an illness, a mental illness. So I think those are two sides of the fence. One is before you get to that realization that it's just a part of you and accept it, and it doesn't make you so unusual or so out of the ordinary. And after that point, when you can start living more for yourself,
that isn't necessarily an easy place to get to, right?
No, it isn't. It took me many, many years to get there. Many years. But again, I was hopefully now with what you're doing, what other people are doing, in terms of bringing out the fact that mental illness is more common than previously thought, and there are fabulous treatments for it that weren't known before. I was in the lithium era, and lithium is now not prescribed that often anymore. There are much better drugs that are prescribed for dealing with bipolar disorder. And so I think that's a major change in what's gone on before.
I like to refer to that time as the personal stigma. It's such a prevalent part of dealing and working through mental illness, and it's often one that's overlooked. I always tend to say that I don't know which is worse, the 10 years prior to my diagnosis sometimes, or the 10 years after of working through the horrors of personal stigma. It was, I mean, I think that the reason why I asked you that question specifically is because my initial thoughts were, how in the world can I be successful now that I'm deemed mentally ill? And I've run into so many people, have conversations with people where, yes, they struggle for years and years with that very idea, and it can hinder your recovery. And so, the goal of the show, and the goal to have people like you on the show, is to show that, yes, even though that's part of working toward recovery, it is possible to work through it and accept it and realize that you don't have to be your disorder, and your disorder doesn't have to be you.
Exactly. That's a great expression, by the way, personal stigma. I think that resonates very well with what I went through, and I think it's very common when one is diagnosed with a mental illness or knows someone who's diagnosed with mental illness. So that's a great expression, and I think that's part of the healing curve. I mean, it's hard enough, like you said, the terrible 20s. It's hard enough as, quote, a normal adult, whatever normal means again, to self-actualize and understand who you are and be comfortable with yourself and all that, and that takes years and years and years. And when you slap on top of that the mental illness, that makes it all the more difficult, because it's hard to separate normal feelings, normal self-doubt, from self-doubt perpetuated by the idea of having a mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, we just have one more minute. So I just wanted to kind of give you the floor to leave us with just a tidbit of your knowledge and wisdom of what you've been through, and just anything that you want to leave us with that just kind of encapsulates what you your life with bipolar and how you live and how you live successfully and everything that you've been through.
Well, first of all, thank you for the forum today. That's one thing. I appreciate being able to hopefully contribute to someone else's dealing with this. I think the most important thing that I can think about in terms of my own self-vigilance is being vigilant, and it's a daily thing every day to monitor the moods and to understand what's happening. And if you can get in touch with that, that I think would be whether you have mental illness or not, would be a major step towards mental health and happy living. If you can understand where your moods come from, and it's especially important in mental illnesses, or especially something like bipolar disorder, where moods can swing at a moment's notice. So I think just being aware of how you're feeling and what you're thinking, and the appropriateness of the thought and feeling to the moment, and measuring, comparing the two, and if it's inappropriate, to be able to act on it in a positive way. So
I want to thank you for all that you are doing, and I continually just feel inspired by how you just kind of took the ball and ran with it. That is for sure. I remember when you told me after the interview that you decided that you were going to write this book and then start talking openly about bipolar. I felt so inspired. So I'm so glad that our paths crossed. For sure, David.
Yes, same here, Chrissy. Absolutely. You've been a major positive factor in my life since I met you, and I appreciate what you're doing, and I value what you're doing. And if I can help in any way, at any time, you know how to reach me.
Thank you. And for those of you that are listening who are interested in purchasing David's book, which I highly recommend, it's Entering the Real World by David Kramer, and you can find that at, you said Barnes & Noble, Amazon, here at Tattered Passport, is that correct?
Tattered Cover, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Tattered Cover. there will be a book signing on April 20th at Tattered Cover. Which location is that? Is that the downtown location here in Dallas?
The Lodo, the downtown location at 7 o'clock.
Excellent. Well, I will definitely be there. So
well, that's great.
We'll do our best to promote it, and I'm excited for you. And again, thank you for being on the show, and thank you for all that you do, David.
You're welcome. Thank you. Ditto.
So we are going to move forward here. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some events that have happened here in the in recent times with mental illness. I'm going to bring on a co-host, as well as we're going to kind of have a guest co-host come on a little bit later. But first, before we do that, I just wanted to tell you that Mental Illness Matters, which is previously called the Stigma of Mental Illness Radio, is funded by, it's listener supported completely. And if you're interested in contributing to the show and to being part of this movement, you can go to www.patreon.com/the Stigma of Mental Illness Radio. There's a video of me you get to kind of see what I look like and what I'm doing, as well as a description of who I am and how I got to this point in my life dealing with obsessive compulsive disorder, as well as navigating through personal stigma. So please feel free. You can donate anything from $1 on up per show. Your credit card won't be charged till the end of the month based on how many episodes we have. I typically only do one a week, which equals 4 to 5, depending on how many weeks are in a month. So I just want to thank, and David actually is one of my supporters, so thank you so much for that. And I just want to thank all of my supporters for contributing, because this show really is making a difference. I get a lot of feedback, not only from people who are living with mental illness, but also the support system of people of mental illness, because they also feel a lot of the brunt of the symptoms, and just trying to support someone and be there in a positive manner can be a very difficult task. So speaking of that, my co-host, Miss Margaret Sisson, I had her on a few weeks ago to talk about to kind of describe who she is and why she got into advocacy and some of the topics that we were going to talk about. And today she's coming on. It's a little bit unscheduled. We were supposed to do this last weekend, and it kind of fell through the cracks. And then I'm going to have her come on, and then we are going to have a guest come on, Mr. Kevin Putnam. And when he comes on, I'll have him introduce himself. Margaret, are you there?
I am here, Chrissy.
Oh, yay. Okay.
Perfect timing.
I had problems earlier trying to get David on, and so I was like, oh, no, is it going to happen again?
Really, I listened to the kind of the ending of his talk, and wow, very inspirational.
I hear Miss Gracie. I hear.
Yes, Miss Gracie. Okay. And okay, so
here we are. So Margaret Sisson is an advocate for. Specifically, she advocates for OCD and addiction. And if you don't mind, I'll just say a little bit of background. So her son Riley had OCD and addiction, and she is an incredible support. And unfortunately, Riley did lose his battle with mental illness this past year, and it was pretty devastating for all of us. And if I've never said it before, Margaret, I just, like, my admiration for you you to be able to do what you're doing now, despite what you've been through over the last 6 months, but just continuing to just, you know, head down, let's just forward and do everything you can for advocacy. I just want to share that with you, just how much I admire you. I'm sure you already know that, but I just wanted to say it out
you,
loud.
Kathy. I appreciate it. I appreciate that. You have been a big support for me through this journey. So thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. And our goal is that when Margaret comes on, we're just going to talk mental health issues, and we're going to talk about our different opinions and things that matter to the mental illness community. There are always a lot of questions that we get, and there are always a lot of topics that that aren't necessarily broached, I feel like. That and coming from a different perspective, especially Margaret being a support, myself being someone that lives with a mental illness, I think that we bring it'll be a rich discussion. Now, I see that somebody else just got on the line, and now would that be Mr. Kevin Putnam?
I made it.
Yay.
Somebody forgot to tell me what time I was on the radio.
I think I even just forgot to tell you you were going to be on, by the way.
Yeah, that's. I heard a rumor that I might be, but I never heard when, where, or, but, you know, it's working out. It's fine.
I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad that you made it. We need to just try our best, by the way, just not to laugh the whole time and not talk, because I feel like that's
right.
Like the potential that could happen here. I'm gonna actually let you tell who you are, Kevin, why you're here today. You might not even know, so just make up a reason. And
yeah, all right. Well, my name is Kevin Putman. And I am from Lansing, Michigan, and I'm actually in Georgia right now at the same house as Margaret Sisson. So she's in another room, and I'm in the front room. I'm standing on the big cow rug in the front room, Christy, if you know what I'm talking about, right by the piano with all the pictures of Riley. And so, yeah, I have OCD. And, you know, had my struggles and I'm still struggling, but I went through treatment in 2010 at the Houston OCD program, which really changed my life. And then from that experience, I started a nonprofit for obsessive compulsive disorders called Run OCD. And what we do is we raise advocacy and funds for obsessive compulsive disorder. And we do that through, we run a support group, I do some speaking. And then the big thing that we do is our ping pong for OCD tournament. And so we just get together, play a bunch of ping pong, hang out, have a lot of fun under the pretenses of mental health and obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm-hmm. Kevin actually has been on the show before as an interviewee, and it was just before he came out to Denver last year, probably right around this time. And I'm sorry we didn't have another tournament. Things just got too busy. But either way, he came out last year. We had a tournament here in Denver, and it was such a blast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway,
we're going to do one in Georgia, Chrissy. So start making your flight schedule.
Yeah.
And we'll have one here.
We were just talking about it.
Please don't let it be in June. I mean, how many
No, not in June. Not in June.
Okay, good. Well, I guess I'll be in Georgia about 8 times a year now. And I will be looking forward to the macaroni and cheese and the mashed potatoes.
Oh, Chrissy, Margaret has to tell you about the present that I brought her.
Priceless.
Okay, back to the show.
Okay, back to the show.
The reason why Kevin is, we brought
Kevin
Chrissy,
on today. You're the host, so you got to keep us together, okay?
I know.
You know, it's very difficult to have. I could see the two of you, it could be different, but I don't know what's going on over there. Kevin is visiting Margaret in Georgia, and we just thought it would be so much fun for us all to go get together. Now, unfortunately, I'm going to have to steer this conversation into a more serious note. And that is, Margaret, I don't know if you had a chance to watch it, the video
I
that
did.
I posted.
Did you? I did.
Okay.
And I've actually read a couple media the articles in the paper, the Atlanta paper, and about the flight and et cetera. So yes.
So a little bit. What I wanted to talk about today is it's a little bit spur of the moment, but I think it's something that's important to talk about, and it's important to have several different perspectives, especially people who are involved in mental health advocacy. Weigh in on it. So the topic of violence and mental illness has bothered me for years and typically makes me pretty angry, which is not helping the violence cause. But I don't get violent. But anyway, I always get super frustrated when something happens, that when there's some mass violent crime committed, and the first thing that we do is we look at it and say, well, that person must have just had a mental illness. Now, granted, and unfortunately, many people have committed these acts of atrocity, and it does turn out that they have a mental illness. However, what happens is that when the media splatters it all over the place, saying these people are unstable, we can't trust them, this pushes people farther back into the mental illness closet. That's the way that I like to describe it. I don't want to come out to people and tell them that I have a mental illness, because they're going to compare me to these people that are committing these horrible crimes. So I just kind of wanted to open up with that. Kevin, I don't know if you had a chance to watch it, but I posted a video, and you can find my video on YouTube at my YouTube channel, Christy Hodges, CHRISSIEHODGES. I posted a video, basically just a 10, 12 minute video, what my opinion is on this topic, but you can go watch that on YouTube, but right now I just want to talk to y'all about it. Tell me what you think when you hear this. And this is all based on what it was just a couple of days ago when that dude flew that plane into the Alps, intentionally, and now they're digging into his past about the fact that he has depression. So tell me what y'all think.
I just really appreciate that you dropped y'all twice in one sentence there.
Margaret, do you have a ruler?
You know what? Chrissy, I'm going to go first. I can't see him. He's in another room. So
we did that on
purpose. I did. And on a serious note, I mean, horrendous. But that is the media. In every situation, I mean, I see the media is out of control. Social media, you know, from bullying to it takes a hold of something and can destroy somebody. So what happened? And I'm going to say, Chrissy, I mean, and I saw I listened to the video and I read some of the media. Really, they don't know for sure. So, of course, the media does lots of assumptions and feeds that. So horrendous what it was. I don't always want, you know, whether it was mental illness, but there's also the component of, like you said, immorality. I'll even put the word evil. That isn't associated with mental health. generally, people with mental health are like you said, they're the ones that are either hurt or bullied or made to feel bad, and most of mental health are the kindest people. Sometimes the kindest people you'll ever meet. And so I struggle with that too. If that was what he struggled with, I think there's probably other underlining circumstances to that that we don't know. And, of course, the media jumps right on it with mental health. So, and you're right. And if it is mental health, not, and I don't excuse it, and I think it's horrendous, but why couldn't he get some help? That's the problem.
That is the problem. And it is, when these things happen, people are going to be less likely to reach out for help, because they don't want to be labeled as a violent murderer that at any moment could snap and just eliminate everybody around them. And that, I think that's what really makes me angry, is that it makes people more reluctant to be able to say, by the way, I suffer with a mental illness, because, you know, they're going to be terrified of the reaction of the people around them.
Yeah, and the largest percent—that is such a minute percent of mental health, people with mental health issues. But that's, you know, that's going to be the story of the day. So, but in general, no, that is not what mental health, you know, struggles are. So, but the media is going to play on that.
Well, and whenever something happens, there's always, you know, you folks want to put blame to something. They want to point a finger and they want to find a reason for something. And I think a lot of times when things happen and you're looking to place blame, it's easy to place blame on something that you don't know a lot about. And, and mental illness is something that people just don't know a ton about it. So it's easy to place that label and to say, oh, okay, this happened because of this. And then that makes it easy. Like A plus B equals C. You know, this happened because this person had mental illness. So, and then it's generalized. Like, okay, everyone who has mental illness does this, or everyone who has cancer does this. You know, it's easy to start putting people in these categories. And, you know, the media is really good about just taking one thing and creating a culture around that one event or statement.
And
I think that one of my colleagues said yesterday, and this really resonated with me, and just to clarify the video, Kevin, and I got some input from some of the people that I work with in the field, just so I didn't get on the video and like a crazy person. one of the things that she said, and I really appreciated and understood, is that a lot of times people have this, what happens is they meet people like me and you, Kevin, and, you know, Riley, and the, you know, the people that we know. And I know so many people with mental illness, but I mean, some of my best friends have mental illness, and they tend to say, oh, but you're the exception. You're the exception to the rule. And I want to go, no, that's not true. They're all around you. Mm-hmm. You just don't know it because they're scared to tell you.
Right.
And
well,
I think that's
the thing about it.
That's a travesty.
The thing about it is that everybody has something. You know, everybody does. And the people that will tell you that they don't have something, that's what they have. You know what I mean? So it's so easy for everybody to point the finger at someone else and not look at their own self and be like, you know, I could have something just the same.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, that's because people don't talk about it, and everybody has stuff, and it's what you know, what they'll talk about.
Mhm. Yeah, point the finger at everybody else. Don't point it at me. You know, whoever put out that report or wrote those articles regarding this person and this plane and this situation, I mean, you dig a little bit into their background and who knows what you'll find. But, you know, let's talk about everybody else. Let's place blame in other spots.
Well, so here's my question. My question to all of us and to everybody is that what are we going to do about this moving forward? I mean, obviously we don't have any sort of, I mean, there's no possible way that we can take over the media. But do we need to make our voice louder? Do we need to just do what we do? Do we need to keep quiet? Because my fear is that this is seriously going to make an impact. It's going to make a negative impact on people in moving forward with the, I don't want to disclose to people in my job that this is what I'm dealing with, but in that fear, it's going to be fear-based. It's going to be the, I have to keep things quiet because if I don't, then this might happen. I may get fired or, you know, I may get rejected. And so what are we supposed to do? I feel like our hands are tied now.
Kevin?
I know. I don't know what to do. I really don't. Because I wish I did.
Well, let's
see. Lydia.
Right this second. Right now, we're solving world problems right now. We got 30 minutes.
And you know what, Chrissy? This is Margaret's opinion. You know, raising awareness and educating, which we are all doing, and that changes little by little. You can't change it, you know, like Riley always said, the big picture is one person at a time, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And that will make a difference.
The more people that come forward instead of trying to hide what they have, but, you know, to come, I don't want to say come out with it, but, I mean, that's the thing. You know, like Chrissy, you and me and Riley and all these people that we know, that way the numbers are not just a exception to the rule. You know, well, Chrissy has mental illness, but, you know, Chrissy's the exception. Riley has mental illness, but Riley's the exception. And the more people that are doing that, then it's not the exception anymore. It's
right.
Almost normalizing it and saying, okay, there it is. Everybody I know has something, and they're, you know, you don't have to be 100% proud and, you know, start a nonprofit or have a radio show, but just not to hide it either.
But
right.
Here's the problem. So, yes, while I agree, when this kind of stuff happens, that's what makes people not come out and talk about it. So this is where I feel like I get angry, is that every time something like this happens, instead of just, hey, let's wait and focus on the facts, or hey, let's figure something out, it's always like, headline, he took 6 months off to be in rehab for depression, and I'm sure that's what caused this, and blah, blah. So all these people out there with depression are like, oh, crap. I told my boss I had depression. I'm going to get fired tomorrow because he thinks that I'm going to, like, blow up the place. So these kind of things really perpetuate that fear. So we are going to be faced with the fact that people aren't going to want to come out. They aren't going to want to talk about it because they're too afraid of what's going to happen as a result. Does that make sense?
Well, people are afraid to do that even before big media situations are happening. You know, I mean, it's just, when the time is right for folks to come forward and to share with their spouses or their bosses or their family, that's when they're going to do it. And I don't know if you can speed that up. And I don't even know if something like this actually does set that back or not. I mean, when people are ready, I think it'll happen.
Yeah. I mean, and I go back to that, Chrissy, I think, you know, you can't, it is a big deal to try to change, but you could, and if you say, oh, God, it makes me angry and you can't do anything, well, that's not going to help either. You got to keep pushing forward, moving forward, and the media... you know, the media is a difficult aspect to tackle. they dominate, you know, what we hear now, and now with social media and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's hard. But I've got to think that we continue to do what we do, and just like your radio show and having Kevin, myself on, and all the good people you have, that makes a difference.
Oh,
And maybe that person says, gosh, you know, it's okay. Because like I say, you know, 90%, 95%, it's not mental health issues. It's not violent. It's not, you know. So I can't, you know, we can't fix it overnight. That's for sure. But I think if you keep doing what you're doing, you'll make a difference. You know, I'm doing this talk on Tuesday morning to the county, you know, administrators and teachers, and I'll show a picture of my Riley, who is this good looking, you know, anybody you'd see walking down the street kid, and I say, you know, this is the face of mental health, mm-hmm. and I hope that makes an impact where people go, wow, you know, that changes their thought. And a lot of them, some of them will know Riley, and some of them won't, but that's, here's this great looking, you know, young man, but I say, this is the face of mental health. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that's all we can do.
Well, I think that the vision piece is, I mean, I've always envisioned this, you know, some sort of campaign, you know, that like
right.
billboards across America, you know, this is the face of mental illness, videos of people, this is what mental illness looks like. Because you know what we get stuck with? We get stuck with these BS Adam Lanza, you know, like with their like freaking Muppet hair or whatever, like looking all crazy eyed, you know, after they
mm-hmm.
after they mass murdered a bunch of people, and then it's, oh, but he suffers from a mental illness. Well,
right.
That's what people associate as the face of mental illness when they're probably sitting next to somebody who has a diagnosable mental illness as their coworker. And I think that
mm-hmm.
pisses me off. I don't know if I can say that because I think this is rated PG. But I don't know if that's a bad word anyway. But anyway, I think that's what makes me frustrated is that it's, you know, one of the people that one of my colleagues yesterday when we were talking about this is that we thought it would be so much more effective to have equal time of all the negativity for the violence and mental illness and the positivity of mental illness. Now, of course, positive stories don't sell, which is irritating. And nobody wants to see, oh, look, because they're probably going to think that's just the exception. However, I mean, what is it? I mean, I don't understand why we can't, and maybe I'm just impatient, but why it's so hard to want to look at organizations like the IOCDF, look at these, you know, Bipolar Foundation, suicide prevention, where these everyday people right next door to you are dealing with these major issues and they look just like you. They don't look like some freak show, you know, that, you know, maybe doesn't even have a mental illness, but went and committed this horrible, horrific crime and is pawning it off as a mental illness. Okay. I just made
mm-hmm.
a huge assumption, by the way. But I'm just making the I don't want the poster child for mental illness to be the freaking Aurora shooter.
Right. I gotcha.
What do you think, Kevin?
I think you're fired up and it's good. That's what I think.
Well, why aren't you fired up is what I want to know. Well, my humidity.
No. Unfortunately, we don't have any of that. Yeah, I think, you know, I think what Margaret is saying, which is the fact that we can't change the world in a one radio show. You know, I mean, we're just
why not?
Why not? Chrissy wants it now.
But she wants some immediacy there.
We can change the world with radio show. We can.
Oh, I don't think.
That
I'm not trying to I'm not trying to say that we can't, but these things just take time. And that's the unfortunate part about it, is it's just not going to happen overnight. And we being the mental health community, is up against a lot because the media is much bigger than us, and they're looking for that sensational, story. But mental health is not the only people that get that. I mean, it's just the media.
Yeah,
gonna
you're
do
right,
it.
And that's exactly right, Kevin.
You know, whatever your cause is, whatever your situation is. I mean, there's people that are like, oh, every time this happens to college athletes, every time this happens to us, whatever that your group is, the media is going to paint that picture that they want to do, So I think it's good for us to remember to just keep doing the good work that we're doing and doing the best that we can. And then the pendulum will swing and it eventually will change, but it's not going to happen today. Sorry.
And it has changed, Chrissy. I mean, it has changed. I mean, you look back, 10 years, 15 years ago, and it has changed. So, yes, it's slow, but it is changing. I mean, little by little. So, and I think it's because of, you, and if we continue what we're doing. Because if we say, oh, man, there's no way we can make a change and give up, well, it won't. I always say, I don't know, what's that? There's that quote. You can do, individual people can do little things, and it ends up being, makes a big difference.
I know. It's just hard not to get frustrated. I mean, the truth is that, so I saw this thing on Facebook the other day, and I'm sure y'all have seen this. And every time I see it, I feel like picking my computer up and throwing it across the room. And, now I'm sounding violent, and I'm not.
I wonder if maybe the anger issues aren't going on inside of you, Chrissy. Your own computers.
Do we need to have a show about that, Chrissy? About you?
Yeah. We need an intervention. What we need.
I do not have anger issues.
Sorry. So
I would not throw the computer.
Okay. So what did you see on Facebook
So we saw this thing on Facebook the other day, and so So what I'm saying is this: is that probably a huge frustrating component of this is. You we do what we do, and we post things, and we people know what we're doing, and Chrissy's that mentally ill girl that the advocate for this and this and this. And then I see this thing the other day on Facebook. Someone that's like, a friend of mine posts something on Facebook, and it's that tile thing where there's like a bathroom tile, and it says, which tile is different? Channel your inner OCD. I looked at that, and I looked at who posted it, and I thought, WTF? I mean, what? and so that's where I get to the point where I think, some people maybe they're just unreachable, or they just don't really care. Or, I want to reach every single person in the world, but it's just not going to happen. But when I see those kinds of things, every once in a while, I'll think, oh, my God, nothing that I'm posting is making me different. Does that make sense?
Okay, but, Chrissy, was that somebody you knew?
Yes.
That posted that?
Yes.
Well, you need to make a personal phone call and say, hey, I saw your post. I mean, that's where you kind of change, people have learned when they say, oh, I'm so, that, like Riley always said, oh, I'm so OCD, and people don't really say that to me anymore, because, if nothing else, at Riley's service, we educate them.
Yeah.
And so, look, you know, look at
this. I definitely took my battle, but I just saw that and I just thought, oh my Lord, what?
Yeah, and that's going to keep happening, and you know. And then, and if it's somebody you know, you say, "Hey, I saw your post. Let me tell you." And then I don't think they'll post that stuff again.
Let me tell you what I think about your title.
You know, don't get your anger card on, Chrissy. You got to be just be pleasant.
Sounding like I'm the angriest person on the planet right now.
But it is when you say to people, and that's how they get it. They're like, oh wow, and you know, maybe it took 2 or 3 times to hear it, but they'll get it.
Kevin, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that just seems so commonplace, and I know that it shouldn't be, but you know, people say, oh, I'm so depressed, when they really don't have a clue on what depression is, or on OCD, and they really don't understand what it is. But, I mean, there's been words and statements in our culture that folks have used as commonplace, and over time through education and awareness, you know, folks mm-hmm. stop doing that. So I think, like, telling people not to do it with anything never seems to work. So I think what Margaret was saying, that just with the awareness and education, and you meet mm-hmm. someone who truly struggles with depression, and you're going to be more apt to not say, oh, I'm so depressed. Or if you have a connection with someone who has OCD, you're going to be more apt to not say, you know, use it in such a commonplace term, because it's not.
And I just want to make sure that we foster an environment for people to, I want to make sure that there is that environment where people start to feel safe about disclosing what it is that they're going through. And so I just think, you know, especially this week, I got this random email from someone that I know that was talking about this particular phone crash and just kind of the double-sided stigma or something. I read it at 5 a.m., so it's a little blurry, but it made me, like, wake up, fired up. I should not read emails that early. That's all I have. Or Yahoo comments. And so I think that that's probably what it was, is that it just was, you know, we've been seeing these things over and over and over in the media, and it always tends to go back. People often will say to me, well, I think that anybody who commits a horrific crime has to be mentally unstable. And my response to that is always, well, sure. I mean, obviously, when someone's in their right mind, morally, ethically, mentally, emotionally, whatever, they're not going to be, you know, doing harm, right? But there are more crimes committed on a daily basis that are crimes of greed and crimes of passion and crimes of anger and whatever else that have nothing to do with mental health. I think that what you said, Kevin, earlier was spot on, is that we need to latch on to something. People need to latch on to something so they can make sense out of it.
Right.
And I think that my issue is I've gotten to a point where I'm really tired of people latching on to mental illness as an excuse. That's where I am. And I want everybody else to feel that way too.
Keep doing what you're doing, Chrissy, and you make a difference. That's all you can do.
Yeah,
all you can do.
I feel exactly like because in the video I said, when you say these things, when people post on social media that, you know, only somebody with a mental illness could do that, they're basically talking about me. I mean, they're basically pointing the finger at me. I identify as a human being with a mental illness. Some people disagree and don't think that I should use that terminology, but I don't care. But, I mean, that to me is, you're generalizing someone, that's me. That would be like saying that everybody with diabetes is X, Y, and Z, which isn't true, right?
I agree.
Yeah, I think
so. You
think
keep
that.
Educating and raising awareness, and that's how you change that.
God, I hope so. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get someone into the media.
Get someone where?
Like into the media, like a fired up spokesperson. That just every
yeah,
time.
I mean, that's, you know, I know, like, Glenn Close, her website, or she's really done a great job with talking about mental health, you know, because of her sister, and has really, and the media listens to her because she's famous, and Patrick Kennedy, and you know, about, he's more addiction, and so.
Who's that?
Yeah.
Who's Patrick?
He's one of the Kennedys and struggled with addiction, and maybe mental health too. He's really making a, you know, he's, you know, through A2A. I know Jeff Bell has interviewed him, and he's become a real spokesman.
Good.
Yeah. So, you know, because he struggled with it. So, I mean, that's, and Glenn Close's sister struggled with it. And I'm assuming a lot of, well, and, you know, I mean, it's coming out more like, you know, Robin Williams, obviously what happened, but people are coming out more, you know, the Hollywood people, and that's what the media listens to, unfortunately. That's I don't want to be, but, you know, and hopefully the Hollywood people will make a difference and use their celebrity status to make a difference.
Well, so here's a question for y'all. Where do you see, I mean, so obviously we're in the middle of this movement. This, okay, people are starting to come out and talk about their, you know, their personal situation. People that typically wouldn't, unless we were in this day and age, and they have some sort of rights to keep their job or to keep their relationship, et cetera. So where do you see this movement in 10 years from now? Well, what would you like?
Well, it's going to be a lot better than it is now. You know what I mean? It's just, I mean, you look at civil rights, you look at all the big movements in the history of this country, and it was started grassroots, just some everyday folks trying to make a change, but it took time, and it, you know, caught momentum, and with those big movements, they're still happening. You know, we're not there yet with any of them. You know what I mean? So the mental illness is not going to be any different, I don't think, where it's still going to take the time. It's, you know, it's got the grassroots momentum. It's getting started. It's starting to change. It's starting to happen. But it's, you know, in 10 years, it probably won't be where we would want it to be in 10 years. That's for sure. But it'll be farther down the road than we are right now.
What do you think, Margaret?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, look at, you know, like, there have been changes, and it doesn't happen overnight, but it's probably individual people that make, as a group, make a difference, and if people keep working on it, just like it in every movement, if you keep at it, there is a change.
Do you think it's a generational thing?
Well, you look back 30, I mean, and, you know, say my parents' age, I mean, nobody talked about mental health. Nobody. That's just, well, you didn't talk about that. I mean, people just kind of went away to get help, and nobody talked about it. They were just gone. you know, I mean, look at the difference now. I mean, no, it's not perfect, but there is a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that gives you some good perspective, you know. Instead of trying to look at 10 years from now, maybe look at 10 years ago and how mm-hmm. far we have come.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean,
what was happening in 2005? I think I got married in a year. Briefly.
Briefly.
Seriously?
Oh, Chrissy.
I'm not lying.
Well,
so,
I think
have happened since 2005.
Even from 2005, Chris, I think, I mean, I'll look at Riley. We didn't, even back then, we didn't talk a whole lot of, you know, and now I'm going to talk to the county school.
Right.
So, okay, right there. There's a, it wasn't talked about in 2005. We hid it. It wasn't, you know, we didn't want Riley, you know, Riley didn't want anybody to know. He was embarrassed. So, okay. There's
Kevin,
a good example, even just from 2005.
Kevin, how long did it take you to kind of start talking about what you went through, even after or before treatment? Or, I mean, were you open with it from the get-go or what?
I was pretty open from the get-go, but it took me a long time to figure it out. I mean, I didn't know, you know, I've had OCD my whole life, and I didn't really figure out what it was until my 20s, and then I didn't get into treatment until my 30s. So once I got out of treatment, then I was very open with it for the fact that I realized that I wasn't the only one. And there was more people just like me that were living in silence, whether they knew it or they were hiding it because they were embarrassed or they were ashamed. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, the only way to get better is to talk about it, and you got to know who you can talk to and where you can go. Because that was another frustration that I had, was I didn't even know where to go or what to do. And the more people that are coming out and are having places, you know, support groups and online groups and conferences and radio shows. I mean, all that kind of stuff is so helpful because some people have somewhere to go now where
yes.
they didn't always. Because even though there's not maybe a ton of people talking about it, there is a culture of people that are talking about it. And the more people that can get into that culture and find that culture, then it's going to grow and not be such a minority.
Mm-hmm. Same conversation yesterday about all this. And one of the things that this person said was that you could look at it like politics, that there are some people that are just dead set on, you know, the way that they believe. And there's nothing that you could say that could ever convince them otherwise, right? And then there's other people that are, like, let's say in my perspective, like what I believe politically, there are people that believe completely against me. And there's nothing I can say to ever convince them, right? And then there are the people that I identify with. And so everything that they say and everything I say, it's almost, yay, look, we believe the same way. Look, we're right. And then there's that gray area of people, the in-between people. And the point that this person made was that those are the people that we have to target. We're not necessarily going to have to convince, or we're not necessarily going to convince these people that are just dead set in their ways. They're always going to believe that mental illness is this. They're always going to believe that mental illness is that. And nothing that can happen, even in their own life, is going to change their mind. But we can start by changing the people in the middle.
So you're saying you have to target the fence sitters.
The who?
The people who are sitting on the fence. The fence sitters.
Okay.
You know, they could go one way or another. too, because you have your folks that are in support, then you have your folks that are dead set on, you know, this is how it is, and then you have your people in the middle, like you said, in the gray area, that, you know, could go either way. So that's, it makes sense, because those are folks that change will be easier with them, because they are at least open, or maybe not as much open as they're not dead set on one thing or another.
Well, and Chrissy, I think the more, and I say that, even people with mental health, the way, when you present it, you know, and I take you guys and Riley, who are just good people, and gosh, what you offer so much, and are kind, empathetic, all your qualities. And when people see that, and I'll say that, because if you go out with that anger and that, you know, people are going to go, oh, but when they see, wow, you know, what a nice guy or what a nice girl, that becomes the face of mental health for them, a different face. Because they'll go, oh, well, gosh, I know somebody who struggles with mental, and they are the nicest and, you know, kind. And so I think that, and I think whether you have mental health issues or not, I mean, I think that's just kind of the way we should live anyway. And, you know.
Yeah, you're not going to get changed by forcing it down somebody's throat, that's for sure.
Right, right.
You raise awareness, you educate, and you let it. The change happened.
I know. I just want to put on the gas.
and that's but you have to watch how you do it and keep presenting it in your good way.
And we all do, and we're all like, we're all triggered by things, and we're all, I mean, put in our specific situations, especially the three of us, too, with the advocacy that we do, it's imperative to be able to communicate rationally to people about it. I just think, in general, when things like that, what just happened, happens, it just, like, it breaks my heart. And it just, I just think, oh, my God, please don't let this set us back. You know, I don't think that it's, you know, things like that can set us so far back that we're not going to be able to bounce back. It just scares me. You know what I mean? It scares me. It scares me for everybody, because it's hard to understand how to have the balance of feelings of the empathy for what happened, of the tragedy, but at the same time, try to have empathy for someone who was suffering. It's just, it's a bizarre reality. And unfortunately, we have like 60 seconds left. They just came on and told me we have 60 seconds left.
Okay, so we can't solve the world tonight, but that's, yeah.
Hey, I think we may have gotten a little bit closer to solving it all.
I think we're close.
Closer than when we started.
Exactly.
Well, okay, so y'all go and enjoy your macaroni and cheese and your mashed potatoes.
Potato salad and fried chicken night.
Yes. Potato salad, fried chicken.
Oh, my God.
Wish you were here, Chrissy.
Yeah.
I wish I was
here. We miss
you. Thanks for calling in. I love you both. And thanks to everybody who was listening. And you know what? Just understand that everybody comes from a different background. Everybody's dealing with something, just like Kevin said. We just have to have compassion and empathy for everybody and hope that our movement is going to make a difference. Thanks for listening to Mental Illness Matters at Blog Talk Radio. My name is Chrissy. Are y'all still there?
Oh, well, I'm still here. Are we done now?
Hey!
Okay, are we...
Well, I just didn't know first.